I am on the faculty in literature here for this week and the next 2 weeks. And today we are in the fourth of five sessions, which really try to look at social action against injustice, political movements, what we think of as movements, by looking back at the civil rights movement and looking at and using literature to illustrate some things, some perspective on politics, on political action. Today's subject is ethical and other perspectives on the movement, and it comes at a particularly good time. Some of the people in this group have been reading a book called Five Smooth Stones, and hopefully some of them are far enough along and have done enough of their homework so that they're going to be able to provide some perspectives today from that book. But beyond that, we're going to look at some other things, including a couple of folk songs to see what they have to suggest. And we're going to pick up a little bit on the discussion last night on the tax protest, just in order to see what sorts of insights the work we've been doing will give us into that. However, at the beginning today, I want to pick up on something that happened a couple of days ago. In the process of looking at the Martin Luther King film and in looking at Five Smooth Stones and talking about the civil rights movement, one of the points that came up is the involvement of the American Union movement in political movements generally and in the civil rights movement in particular. And at the very end of that session, a question was asked. And the question was, isn't there a sort of contradiction in the role of the American Union movement in civil rights? On the one hand, it's very clear that they have been directly involved in the movement. And obviously, the union movement over the years has had a tradition of organizing low-paid workers. And in the film we saw on Monday about the civil rights movement, about Martin Luther King's role in that movement, we saw a strike. And it was a garbage strike in Memphis. Many of you saw it on television at the time it was occurring. And so obviously that was that kind of involvement. At the same time, someone pointed out, the unions have been in the business of discriminating against people, against minorities, by preventing them from coming into the workforce. Well, my response to that at that point was that there is a dilemma there, that when you get down to protecting a craft, you have a sort of an admission and retention job and a control over the work supply. Someone told me afterward that they thought the difference was largely the difference between the old AFL and the old CIO. One a craft union, one an industrial union, the industrial union working to put all kinds of people together. Well, in the process of all of this, we found out we have a resource in Holden Village on that subject this summer, and so I'm going to ask her just to comment briefly on that. With us this morning is Diana DePue, who works for the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, which is one of the unions that has organized textile mills and other kinds of efforts in this country. And I introduced, when I mentioned yesterday that she was coming, I said she was an organizer. She is not. I'll leave that to her to tell you who she is and what she does, and to comment briefly on the role of her union and unions generally, insofar as she can, in this business of dealing with civil rights and minority opportunity. Diana, you want to come do that?
want to preface my remarks by saying I didn't come out of a union family. Not one single member of my family that I know of has been in a union. But I find that I feel very close to the labor movement now that I've been working for the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union for the last 6 years. I originally got connected with the union when I left Pennsylvania to complete my social work education at Columbia University School of Social Work. And as you might know, a field internship is required. You go to school classes 2 days a week, and 3 days a week you actually practice social work. And at that time, a new focus at the School of Social Work was what they call industrial social work, working for companies or working for unions as a vehicle to help people, the work site. And so I was assigned to work for the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union, and I wasn't quite sure what that meant, and I think my parents were a little concerned what that meant. But my job was to work with the retired members, reorganizing them. So in some ways, I was a reorganizer, pulling together groups of retired members in different places around the country as a way of helping them continue their connections with each other, their friendships, keeping a close relationship with the union for both the union's interest and the people's interest, using the strength of the retired members as a political force for their own welfare, preserving Social Security and the programs that were fought for years past, and to support things like national health care, full employment, many other things like that. So I learned from the retired members through that experience how they fought and struggled to form the union and why. Our union is made up at this point of 470,000 members across the United States and Canada. These are people, if I was to describe them in general terms, over 60% are women who work in clothing factories and textile mills. Originally, our union is made of several different unions that merged together. In 1976, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America merged with the Textile Workers Union of America. And more recently, the shoe workers have merged with the union. They said we'll have to call it Act Shoe now instead of Act Two. Every time you add on another union, your name expands. And when I say where I work, sometimes I'm exhausted by the time I say it all. And now the Hatters are probably going to be merging in also. And the thing that these unions have had in common is that they're labor-intensive industries, which means that the cost of a garment, the major cost factor is the cost of labor. It takes many, many different people to put together a piece of clothing or to make textile materials, to make shoes, as opposed to the cost of maybe making an automobile or some other products where the materials themselves cost quite a bit and where it's more automated, so that one person might be running a machine that does many, many processes. Therefore, in order to cut down the cost of making products, the idea I guess a lot of manufacturers have is let's keep those labor costs down. Consequently, the people who work in these industries tend to be immigrant groups to this country, because you don't have to necessarily speak English to run a sewing machine. In fact, you might have sewn in the countries that you came from. So many people came with some skills even though they couldn't speak English. Also, they're more likely to be willing to accept lower wages. They took whatever job was available. In years past, when the union was first formed in the early 1900s, Sidney Hillman was the organizer of the union, along with many other people, and he was an Eastern European Jew. And they were the primary force that came together, struggling in the sweatshops and working together to form solidarity and create a union. The immigrant groups of today tend to be a lot of Hispanics from many, many different Spanish-speaking countries, Puerto Rico, Mexico, and other such places. Also Haitians, a lot of Indochinese refugees, and many blacks are members today. So you see, between the retired members and the working members, there's quite a range of people and of languages spoken, and there's a lot of gaps in understanding, because just because they're immigrants doesn't mean they're all, you can lump them together. There's a lot of differences in what they brought to their job and their values and their attitudes about work. Many of our members who get jobs today, they're so grateful to have a job and things are so much better from where they came that they wouldn't necessarily be what you might call a good, strong union member. And they might not understand the concept of working together in the same way. See, one comment about the formation of our union. Unfortunately, I don't know as many details as I wish I did, but I'm picking them up along the way. When our union was first formed, it was a part of a union called the United Garment Workers Union. And this tended to be a little bit more of an elite union. They were more highly skilled, and they wanted to restrict who could belong. And so Sidney Hillman and a group of other people who wanted to have it be opened up so that it was really open to the people who were in the sweatshops, who really needed a union and protection on their job, they broke off and they formed the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union. And so that's how that started. And traditionally, our union has stood up for the rights of the poor and the working poor, and tried to have the sense of human justice, justice for all. They fought for things like the Social Security system, child labor laws, minimum wage and hour laws, rights of minorities and women. Today, the director of our department is Joyce Miller, who was the first woman on the AFL-CIO, and she is the president of the Coalition of Labor Union Women. And their premise is the way you help women is by helping them organize at the work site. And that's how you help them get fair wages and protection and benefits and all those various things that, that many men have had through unions historically. Unemployment compensation is an interesting thing. Our union is the strongest in Chicago because that's basically where it started. And there's many large manufacturers there. Well, the thing about the clothing industry, it's sort of seasonal. There's times of the year when people are more likely to buy clothing, and there's times of the year when shifting of seasons or summertime or whatever, that a lot of layoffs take place, a lot of temporary layoffs. Well, way back when, in Chicago, one of the union's demands was we need to do something to help our people when they're laid off. If you want to have a workforce available to make clothing when it's needed, you're going to have to do something to help take care of them when you don't need them. And so they negotiated with the manufacturers for unemployment compensation. And this was before the government had any such program. And they were able to negotiate this, and the people received some benefits, some wages, when they were laid off. Later, the United States government used this as a model in setting up the unemployment compensation program that now exists in I believe, most all the states. Then, after this was done, the money that had been set aside for this unemployment compensation program was rechanneled into building health centers, retirement centers, and child care centers in Chicago. In many of the other big cities, there's such programs where there's concentrations of membership. So as you see, our union has a different perspective, and I think it very much is in solidarity with the women's movement, civil rights movement, any movement that sort of furthers the cause of human justice. Let's see, just a couple other points. I just thought I'd make mention of a few problems that the union is facing today. Besides changes in technology, which really changed our industry quite a bit. It used to be clothing workers made men's woolen suits. Cotton garment workers made boys' shirts, men's shirts, underwear, that kind of thing. And there was a big differentiation between women's clothing and men's. Our union made just men's and boys. the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which you probably know their little jingle, they make women's clothing. Well, since the use of synthetic fibers came into being, this has all changed. Now, there aren't too many, if you look in your closet, a lot of your suits, men's suits, are made of synthetics, maybe combinations with wool and cotton. And many women's clothing styles now are that they wear suits also, especially in the work world. And so there's crossover between the unions, making men's and women's garments. And within the various separate industries now, cotton garment workers are making suits, and clothing workers are making all various kinds of garments, and don't have to worry about holding creases anymore. It just changed a lot of different skills and mixing things around. Also, we're affected by the change in the supply of oil and the price of oil, and because many synthetic fibers really have their basis in the oil industry. And so, also the depressed economy. People aren't buying as many clothing as they used to. Another big factor that I left for last is the fact that we now have a world economy. And so American workers, American working poor and poor people, are really in competition with the poor people in other countries. Because manufacturers are looking for cheap labor, if they can find it, cheaper labor some other country, they're going to get it there. And because of the machines that are used in making clothing, are, you know, you don't have to, it doesn't take that much expense to be able to take sewing machines and put them in some third world country and teach people and help them develop skills. So what's happened is there's a lot of imports. If you go looking for clothing and you want to buy American-made clothing, it's really difficult, and you have to examine them closely, because they might say made in America, but maybe they just put the buttons on in America. There's all kinds of little ways to get around these import laws. So thus, we've had many, many plant closings in our industry and mass layoffs of people. And this gets to the work that I do. I work in the social services department of the union, and we help with what we call off-the-job needs, although we recognize that if people have problems or needs, they're with them whether they're at home or at work. But we use the workplace and the union as the vehicle for helping people. One of the things we do is go into communities, and I'll meet with various agency representatives, and I'll try to help them understand why a union wants to work with them for the common goal of helping the people in the community. And to also help them see the people who are members of our union are resources that we can work together in partnership. When there's layoffs, we want to make sure that people know to go sign up for unemployment compensation, to help them see if they're eligible for food stamps, to help them recognize the strain that they go through when they're unemployed. Many people internalize it, even though the forces outside of them are, for the most part, controlling what happens in terms of the closing of that plant. Somehow, just like children blame themselves when there's a divorce of their parents, many workers feel that maybe it was something they did. And there's a lot of blame tossed around, too. Unions are blamed, and I think we all play a part in the situation that we have now. Rising expectations. It's hard for unions because, in one way, workers feel you should go to the bargaining table and get us more money. But it's hard to go and demand more money of an employer who maybe that company will go under if you demand more. It's really tricky. And I think unions are a lot more responsible than it's been painted in the pictures and, I mean, in the newspapers and on TV. I think they try to really understand what's happening in the industry and not push employers into bankruptcy. But it's a tricky business. But there's a lot more to unions than just trying to get higher wages or even higher, better benefits. It's day-to-day in the shop, helping to solve problems, helping people get along together and work together, And it's also the big picture, which you're trying to get at in your session, Duane, about justice for all people.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Everything you're saying here leads me to this overwhelming question, what form. And that is, from your perspective, do you think that the movement to achieve civil rights for minority people, we've been looking especially at black people, but not exclusively, because of what's happened with the desegregation laws and affirmative action, and all of the things that have come about through the movement up to this one, you think that's essentially accomplished? You were to look at your union and your people, the minority people you mentioned and so on, have they arrived in this country? Are their rights now well protected by our laws? Is there going to be 5 years, 50 years, 100 years before they have a real equality, or do they have it now?
I don't think they have it now. When I look at our union, our leadership tends to be the people who helped form the union in years past. And so the membership is one group of people, the new immigrants, the minorities, blacks, Hispanics. The leadership at this time is mostly Jewish. But there is hope. I do see some of the minorities coming into leadership as well. And this is going to have to happen.
That's even within your union?
Within our union. Visiting some of the local unions down south. Okay. I've worked with the retired members. The retired members, a lot of Southern white and Southern black. And the members now are primarily black, and the leadership is black. I don't want to avoid your question. I'm just trying to think. I was going to end by saying I think that there's so much struggle ahead. And I think the union is a force in working towards this. And I think more and more minorities and blacks are now organized. And this organization can be used in many different directions. The signs of hope are like in Solidarity Day. Those same groups that were together back in the 60s are coming back together again to as a sort of a rededication towards, I think, civil rights and the women's movement. Church groups were represented, labor unions, social service agencies that are trying to preserve the programs that they think help the poor. And these same groups were represented at the anti-nuclear demonstration in New York. So I think that there's rumblings. There's still a long way to go. And during hard times like today, when there's unemployment, that sort of breaks down solidarity. When jobs are limited, people want to hang on. And the fear makes distrust. And I see that happening. But the forces to say, we can't be divisive against each other. We have to look at what the forces are and have to stand together in solidarity towards our common objectives of justice for all.
Are there questions that you have? Yes.
You mean the immigrants that have come in are taking jobs of Americans? There definitely is now that in years past, there wasn't this same kind of competition because I think there were lots of jobs in these industries that people didn't really want to work in the factory. But now as more immigrant groups come in, they are available, for a lesser number of jobs. And also there's a lot of undocumented workers that are in the factories. I think manufacturers sometimes find ways of recruiting undocumented because they can prevent them from organizing because they're afraid. But yeah, it's true. There's less jobs and more people for them now.
You heard a great deal about
Mm-hmm.
What happened to the
Well, she works for our union right now. Actually, the Textile Workers Union of America, that's the basis of the story Norma Rae.
Are you familiar with that movie about the female textile worker, Norma Rae, and the union effort to organize a film?
Yeah. Well, if it ever comes back, it gives you a good picture of the textile industry and the problems with the cotton dust and all kinds of things that they face and the difficulty in organizing. She was a union organizer, a young woman, and who really stood up after she saw what working in the mill did to her family and the powerlessness that people felt. She worked real hard with the union organizer to help organize that textile mill. The thing is that that movie ends when the people voted for the union, and they're all saying, yay, union. But boy, it took a long time, until just last a year ago or so, that group of people were actually able to form into a local union. You might have heard of the J.P. Stevens boycott. Well, that boycott was run primarily from our union with the help of many, many other unions and churches, because that movie was based on a J.P. Stevens textile mill. And J.P. Stevens, for years and years and years, has violated all kinds of laws, fair labor laws, and anybody who tried to organize a union, they would sort of blackball them. They would see that they were fired for some reason and then prevent them from getting a job anyplace else. So that many, many companies are now moving down south to get away from unions. And our union and many, many other unions felt that we've got to say, here I stand, as Martin Luther said, and we've got to make an all-out effort to force this company to negotiate in good faith. Those people voted for a union, and now sit down at the bargaining table and recognize that that's a group of people that have formed a union and negotiate a contract in good faith. And that has now happened. That boycott is over.
Other questions?
The general result of that boycott is really effective.
I think there's a lot of mixed opinions about it. We can say that they have a contract now, and there's an arrangement worked out with J.P. Stevens where they will not harass people who try to organize their mills and companies. I think there's four or five local unions now in J.P. Stevens' companies. It was interesting that J.P. Stevens has a company in, I believe, Germany, where they have recognized a union for many years and have all kinds of benefits that they give to those people, but they weren't willing to have a union form in their company here in the United States. But now, it's a beginning. It's not everything that maybe was wanted, but the people who were fired unjustly got back wages and other kinds of compensation. And people now have, instead of getting a lump sum when they retire for a pension of maybe a few hundred or a few thousand dollars, they have now negotiated a pension plan and that kind of thing, and some health benefits. Salary changes. Yeah. You mean that advertisement look for the union label and that kind of thing? Well, we don't get credit for that. That's the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. And I think that the main thing that does is raise a consciousness of unions and looking for American made. And to realize that when you see that advertisement, instead of seeing unions as an overweight, bullheaded man smoking a cigar, you see unions as people. People who are like you, who are trying to work and earn a living, and what they want is a fair break. I think that that's a part of the reason for that.
Because of the presence of political climate,
we're certainly in hard times right now. We're losing members. We're not organizing more to take their place. The problems are big problems. They're not just a matter of organizing one particular shop. They're global.
Coping with that global economy.
That global. And people with still rising expectations of wanting more and better, and having to learn to maybe that more is something else. It's not more money. That's why our department was really organized, so that we can try to help people see more as the union is us working together. Let's sit down and talk about what our needs are, our concerns, and let's see if we can work together and have those needs met, and not just our own, but as part of the community, and see who else wants to work with us, so that it's not just more money, but more us.
Other questions? Well, thank you, Diana. That's really good. Well, go ahead.
You mentioned the fact that we're harassing on the part of the communication executive. Isn't there also occasionally harassment on part of the union?
You mean unions for the company and unions or unions for each other,
unions
turf? Oh, sure. And unions are so different in their approach and their tactics and their ways of working, but humans are always humans, and when there's two sides, there's always going to be frictions, and I think it's important to try to work in a fair and just way, but people are people, and there's going to be harassment on both sides.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Before Diana leaves, I want to do one more thing. As some of you know, we've been using folk songs as illustrations, or songs as illustrations of some of the things we're doing. I want to do a textile worker song here. Oh, good for you. You could even lead us, I bet, huh? Before I do that, though, I just want to say that one of the insights that I got out of this session with Diana is that the J.P. Stevens boycott, again, as we've said over and over again, regardless of where you're coming from about it, is another example of an effort to use the techniques of the political movement to achieve a specific end. In other words, that became an attempt to mount a public force on the side of a very specific objective that the union had. And as she says, the result of that was mixed. Well, you can look at solidarity and say the result of that was mixed in Poland, and we don't always win, or I should say, they don't always win, the people who are taking on an effort like this, but that's one of the characteristics of the movement. This song comes from an album called Groundwork, Songs of Working People, and the person who performs is a person by the name of Joe Uline, who is rather well known in the union folk singing movement, but not much of anywhere else. This is a song by Joe Glazer called "The Mill Was Made of Marble," and I'm going to play it because I think it's really appropriate at Holden Village. The setting of this song, of this poem, is heaven, and it uses a particular form of literature, which is to take an imaginary situation and imply things from that environment, from heaven, about this one. This is a lament, as you'll see, called "The Mill Was Made of Marble." And if you have any problem hearing it, I practically have it memorized by now, but I don't have the text here, but I think it'll be okay. It's a hymn, sorry. You have it.
Can't
Several days ago, we were looking at We Shall Overcome as a song that had started as a hymn and become a union song and then was taken over by the Civil Rights Movement. And as you can see, this sort of thing, this sort of song that you just heard, which is essentially a protest form, a very sophisticated form of it, as protest songs go, could be... That sort of pattern can be used and is used in the civil rights movement. And many of the things that come to us in the in political movements come from there. In fact, come out of that union tradition, which has always worked at organizing in its own field, and had many techniques that have been used by others. I was sitting thinking as this was playing that maybe the big thing that's missing in the tax resistance movement is a good song. There's a certain, you know, there's a certain sense of humor here. It's very serious, but a certain sense of humor about the whole thing, a perspective on it. And you can just hear them enjoying sticking the knife in a little bit, you know, as they go along, which is one of the things we all like to do. Well, we've seen a couple of perspectives here, or a perspective on the civil rights movement. We're not going to get to, well, we may get to Five Smooth Stones today. If we don't, we'll do it tomorrow. I do want to take a little time. How many people here were in attendance at the tax resistance forum last night? Okay. Many of you. I would like to take a little time for sharing on that, because I think that that was an hour of a fairly intense discussion, and on a subject that people have some strong feelings about. And perhaps overnight, there are some perspectives that some of you have on that. Is there anybody who, given the environment in which we're operating here, looking at political movements, and especially in this case at the civil rights movement, is there anything that any of you would simply like to say about your experience last night? If not, we'll move on. But if there is, yes. Pastors here and people who work in that area. How far have we moved since 1970 in that area?
1%.
It's tough. That we're saying is it makes it very tough for clergy to be leaders in a political action kind of movement on an issue that's significant.
Most lay people that I run into in my parish just don't comprehend that there is any connection between that sort of action and our understanding, you know, of the gospel. And more than that, don't want to know that there is that sort of connection. And I think because of that, many of those that I respect have left the ministry. They cannot stand the tension of doing a partial voiceless meeting.
Is that a Lutheran phenomenon, or is that a general one?
I'd say general. I hear people who are not Lutheran.
Yes, you want to say something?
Yeah, I found that comment just extremely interesting. I only half raised my hand in the question because I was visiting another building with a pastor friend, a pastor friend, and so I came down. I thought maybe he checked the last half, maybe the last third, and I didn't know what he was going to put this on. But one of the things he said, he knows, personally knows the gentleman himself, and he supports the position. He says, I'm not ready to go to the fence and go to jail. and I vote, and I do what I do. But one thing I've wondered all week, and I always do this when I come to hope, is I wonder when I see the guy who's here performing a certain specialized function, I see him on fire for a cause. And then if I find out that he's a parish pastor, I wonder what it's like in his parish. Because what's a parish like? And he used the word maintenance. And I take no offense at that at all. What does he have for the guy whose wife has left him? Or the guy who lives in the tavern and the woman is at home with the children? Or the people who are out of work? Not person, people. We're in bad times today. And the children, on and on and on. That's life. That's reality.
That's our town, isn't it? As we were looking at
it. Like respond to that. The problem is with the system that creates havoc in our families and oppresses people. And I have a choice at this point. I can take care of my people, but I have to go beyond my people to talk to a system that destroys them. And if I only take care of them, then that's what I'm going to do the rest of my life. But I have to somehow help the system confront itself and change, or else it will continue to do what it's done.
I think that people believe that their problems and problems are created by the society. Okay? Mary's kind of the same as God didn't raise her, kind of the same way God was raised her. But the pressures of society are so great that it's destructive, destroying families. I think that's pretty well accepted. But when the minister begin to go beyond taking care of that family and begin to look at the system that is putting all of that pressure and the sick society is causing that family to fall apart, the people say, oh, we're getting into social action. And social action is just addressing situations that cause human suffering, and human suffering is
What I'm hearing is a very interesting thing, which I have to confess I hadn't thought very much about before, but I see the tension that started out with this comment here as being one that says there's a flock, a community here, which there's an expectation that it will be dealt with on a local level, and in a kind of response, a way of responding to the pressures of the society. And there's some tension over a pastoral leader who decides to take his work outside that immediate community. Is that correct? Is that part of what this tension is?
Or to encourage people to take their ministry.
All right, to encourage people to take their ministry outside, which is another aspect of that whole thing.
I'd like to get at the question, and I think the study of generations raises, and there's been considerable thought about this, and it goes beyond just the pastor. But we're in a transitional period societally. The symbol bearers are the folks who a lot of things focus on. And I think that the reason that a lot of our people are very uncomfortable with the pastor, who is a major symbol bearer, When one does something that is not in keeping with other major symbols in society, namely law and order, that you create enormous tension. I mean, I think that's part of the value of the act. But then the other thing, in responding to Don, I think one of the things is that we have narrowed our understanding of what needs to be passed to Ernst Cavenman said in his book, Jesus Means Freedom, it's as if we have come to equate hearing the word with what is comfortable for us. I think the pastor has to create a relationship with the congregation that is reciprocal, mutually respectful, that we are going to engage one another in the issues of the day. And I believe it can be done. I believe it can be done, that a pastor can be a major symbol and a carrier and create conflict with other symbols and force people to make decisions.
Doesn't Martin Luther King himself fit that pattern? Largely.
And I think, too, one other thing. Marty talked about why Bishop Hunthausen's actions has had significance, and that is because he has been a pastor to his flock. And now when he calls them to accountability, even though they're very uncomfortable with that, he has had a history with them. And they will, you know, they will deal with him in that history. And I think those are all, you know, I think.
I was going to bring it up last night about my feeling about the pastors representing, going out as ALC pastors or any pastor, and representing the congregation in a movement. When maybe they don't represent the majority of the congregation. And therefore, the congregation gets known as American Lutheran Church is opposed to this, and they don't represent the American Lutheran Church. That's a personal opinion.
That's the great dilemma of people transferring leadership from one environment to another. That's exactly the kind of problem it creates. That makes it very difficult.
Certainly.
To exercise leadership, to be a free. I, there are a number of people here, I don't know how many are here, who are school teachers. And, there's always that same sort of thing. Don't get involved because you don't want to be exposed as somebody who, because people are going to think that what you're going to do is preach your political faith, whatever it is, in your classroom. You know, which is another a kind of tension that I felt over the years many times. Yes?
Lutheran churches were not yet quite as going back for 3 or 4 centuries. They have to start from the other. I think we kind of make a mistake, not mistaken in ethical exemplary prophecy. When you're part of the system, it's hard to be ethical prophet, really out of contact in the system. It's kind of funny. Most of the ancient prophets are outside this system.
I would contest that.
But to equip the saints and have them be your front men and point men on this, I think that's where the local parish man would be. Unless you're in a very strong type structure where your bishop will back you up. Otherwise, we know in Little Rock, those who are in congregational type structures, they lost their job, they will lose that. You've got to be willing to take martyr for that.
Uh-huh.
But there's only so far you can push, it seems to me, in a congregational type system against a fiscal structure. I'm not saying it's right, I'm just saying you've got to work the system and how to move the system a little bit. In the virtue of patience last night. Now, you expect things to happen overnight with God, and we take 2 years to bring this down. He's around stone. I don't know. But I would suggest, hey, look, we've got to start from where we are. And the Lutheran Church is behind about 300 years.
Are there other comments from that? Yes. I must say that this piece of paper, at the very least, and I don't want to suggest it was intentional because I'm sure it wasn't, completely misleads the layman about what it is that was being talked about last night. I got into a couple of conversations at the end of that session and after it. That suggested that the people who were talking there were very much interested in their own personal witness, in the sense that they had to use an old a fundamentalist phrase, which is where I basically come from. They had to get right with God on this issue, and that was the most important thing. What the bishop is saying here, though, is that he'd like to have 500,000. Washingtonians withhold their taxes. And that makes it, in my judgment, a political movement. And you can't avoid that responsibility once you get into it. So there's a need for a great deal more dialogue about this. And being sure to make, to clarify what it is you're trying to accomplish in a given area just seemed to me to leap out last night, and it leaps out again in this discussion today. Well, it's time to quit, folks. I just want to make an announcement about tomorrow, and that is that tomorrow we are scheduled to deal with Five Smooth Stones as a love story. We are going to be dealing with Five Smooth Stones totally tomorrow, not just as a love story, but we're going to try to get into the things that we were dealing with today. It gives you another day to do your reading if you haven't got it done, and to catch up and remember those questions that I asked you about yesterday, those of you who are reading, so that you can provide some help for the rest of us tomorrow. What matters most to those significant characters in Five Smooth Stones individually? We're going to try to put a list of that together tomorrow, coming out of your reading, and then look at that as perspective on the civil rights movement. Also want to mention to you that there is a the other day I pointed out that homosexuality is dealt with as an issue in this book. So is alcoholism. I just reviewed that section last night, and there is a marvelous, terrifying creation, evocation here of the business of being the spouse of an alcoholic and the kind of tragedy that results from that. One of the leading characters is has an alcoholic wife. Other announcement, some of you are going out today, some of you are going out of here tomorrow. I've got to have Five Smooth Stones back from those of you who are leaving. Bring those copies back. Go to your nearest bookstore, and I don't care which kind it is. You'll find Five Smooth Stones there. All the copies I brought here, I picked up off the shelf. It's still available. It's still enough of a seller so that it's available wherever they're sold, and if it isn't, you can get it on special order. And it's worth reading. Don't stop reading it. I'd hate to have people stop at page 200 or wherever you are and never look at any more of it, because it's when you get to the end of it that you begin to get, that you get the real sense of what's there, because it is a creative work, a created work. It's not real, you know, even though we hope to try to get into it and get some feelings about it as if it were.